Bangkok helping Pakistani Christians. And like, these are people who are hungry. They're on the verge of homelessness, and they're in constant danger of being arrested and thrown into the IDC, which is really a modern day concentration camp where conditions are designed to be so bad that people will choose to go back to the country where they're persecuted rather than stay there. I mean, there's tuberculosis, hepatitis, scabies. They cram up to 200 people into a room, maybe like a third of the size of this sanctuary. People have to take turns laying down to sleep, and it's this menace that hangs over Pakistani Christians in Bangkok, and that's where we try to step in and help. And so if I stop there, most people would, just hearing that we're trying to help these people, most people would be really impressed and would say that you know, we're loving them. But one of the things that I've been learning recently is kind of what it really means to love people. And one of the things that really has shaped how we work in Bangkok happened about 6 years ago when I was visiting a church. And this is kind of, this is at the height of the Pakistani Christian influx, when hundreds were coming each year. And this church in Bangkok had really just opened up their heart to Pakistani Christians. And they were feeding about 500 refugees each month. It's just this really, you know, as I heard about this, I was really impressed, like, wow, like, this is a really awesome program. And I wanted to get to know them and see how we could, you know, work with them. And so I met the leader of the program. And, you know, this is the guy, you know, who I imagine, you know, oh, this guy has got to have, like, the best job in the world. You know, he is the one who, you know, is physically, you know, giving food to hungry people. You know, like, what a powerful, like, you know, act of love. Like, how fulfilling must that be? And so I met with him, and it was, you know, he was a hard worker, and in his mind, he knew that what he was doing was good, but there was this sort of this jadedness that he had, and there was this, like, I didn't see any actual compassion in him. And you could see that it was kind of like a burden, like it wasn't something that gave him life to do. And what I saw was that, you know, as he gave them food, that wasn't actually an act of love. It was also clear that as people received the food, they did not receive that in love. And so today I want to dive into what, you know, what we've learned about what it really means to love people and the power of that love. And so to start, I want to kind of talk about what does it mean to love. So love in modern, kind of modern times, it can mean a lot of things, right? So, like, Rick and I both love ice cream, right? Some of you might love kale. but it can mean different things. And but the love that kind of I'm talking about today, and the love that the biblical love, I think, is best defined in 1 John 3:16-17. There we go. All right. Sometimes technology is not as effective as the old-fashioned Bible. So he says, John says, "For we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us. And so we also ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart to him, how does he have the love of God?" And so in this verse, it's defining, you know, it's looking to the cross, right, to Jesus' sacrifice, and kind of defining love as that act of laying down our lives for each other, really putting other people first, that sacrificial love. And the word in Greek is agape, and it's one of the key ideas is that it's an act of love that expects nothing in return. right? So, you know, maybe if my, like, maybe like my friend would ask money, ask me for money, and if I gave him money, but if I'm expecting him to pay me back, that's not an act of love, right? Or you know, if like my wife asked me for a massage, it's like if I'm expecting her to maybe give me a massage back, like that's not so much of an act of love. Now, those aren't bad things, right? So it's not like those aren't, you know, it's sometimes if you don't want to get taken advantage of, but it's that sacrificial love that he's talking about here. And then other thing I want to talk about when it comes to love is, because love is like one of those fruits of the Spirit, right? And I think when we talk about fruits of the Spirit, and even things like love, it can be easy to think of something that we don't have control over. Like it's just something that, like, and I know kind of from in some church backgrounds, there's this idea like if we experience the Holy Spirit, then inevitably the fruits of the Spirit will come. But in Galatians 5, I want to go to Galatians 5:13, and he says, this is Paul. Technological difficulties. For you were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry the desire of the flesh. And what I love about this idea is that it's an idea of walking. Like it's the choice to love. Love isn't just like this experience or this feeling that happens. Love is something that we choose to do. And I think what's been helpful for me to think about it is comparing it almost to like working out, right? So the first time we go to the gym, the first time we go for a run, like it's not easy, right? You're gonna be tired and it's not gonna be fun, but as you do it more and more, it becomes easier. And I really believe that, you know, sometimes if we're out of the habit, the first time we love, whether it's a family member or our spouse, it can feel really uncomfortable and not fun. But as we get in the habit of loving, it becomes more natural and easier to do. And so I think it's just important to have the idea that like, loving isn't just something that happens, but we can choose to love and who to love. I mean, so for me, the next step is love is, again, kind of a general idea. It's, okay, sacrificing, but... And something that's been really helpful for me is thinking about like really, really like let's take the next step. Like, what is it? What are practical ways to love people? And what has really helped me is this idea of people of five. I don't know if you guys have heard it. It's called like the five love languages. So these are five different ways of expressing love. And this is something that I've experienced in my life, and it's also something that we've seen applied as we work with refugees in Bangkok. And so, one of the ideas of this is that different people experience active loves in more powerful ways. So for me, for example, like the acts of love that are most powerful to me are like quality time and physical touch. For some people, gifts are like just really meaningful. So it could be, oh, like if someone gets you a really awesome birthday present and you're just like, oh, like I feel so loved by them. Whereas other times, maybe someone serving you is something like, oh, like they like some, maybe this is more of a mom thing. Like, oh, they did the dishes. Like I feel so loved. So these are kind of the ideas. There are five real practical ways of loving people. And, some people experience love this way, and other people are more naturally giving it this way. But we can do all of them. So one is gifts, in Bangkok, this isn't the most natural like love language for me. But in Bangkok, this is what we do when we go to the IDC, and that's what's really kind of depends on what stage of life you're into. But when you're in prison and hungry, like receiving that gift of food, it feels that's how you experience love, right? And other thing about gifts too is it doesn't have to be like an expensive gift, right? You can idea, oh, I have to like buy something, but it can be even like a small thing that's really meaningful. So then the second way, like practical way of loving would be an act of service. So this would be, for example, like doing dishes, or, you know, we see it in the Bible when Jesus washed his disciples' feet. I do it now very practically when I change my 2-year-old daughter's diapers. And I will say that is a physical, agape love, because I am not expecting anything in return from her. And then the other one, and this has been interesting, is a physical touch. And so one of the really interesting things about living abroad is seeing how different facets of different culture. I'm American, so I'm coming from a very American culture, and then we're working with Pakistani Christians, so they're coming from, you know, their own very unique Pakistani culture, and then we're in Thailand, which is also incredibly different. And so it's been fascinating kind of seeing how unique three different cultures can be. Like, it's not just like East and West, but there's just so many different expressions. And physical touch is one of the really interesting differences in culture. And so in Thailand, I was meeting with a missionary about a year ago, and she was talking about things that like can upset Thai people. And so one of them is like if you're too loud. So I was like, oh, it's like something I have to be really careful of, because I don't even know it, but I'm just a naturally loud American. and then she's also said, or don't ever touch them. There's this idea, there's this kind of discomfort with you know, kind of physical touch usually. And so, like, for example, in Thailand, it's really common to get around on like little motorbike taxis. And so it's really one of the most awesome things about Bangkok, because Bangkok is just, it's a whole nother level of heat and humidity. So like during the summer, which is about 11 months of the year, it's really pretty commonly be around between 90 and 100 and like humid. And so it's an extra hot season when you just kind of take a step outside at like 7 o'clock in the morning and like instantly like the sweat begins. And so motorbikes can be a godsend, because you can, for like a dollar, instead of taking a 15-minute walk and like showing up somewhere like totally drenched through my clothes, I can spend a dollar and I'm there, and it's an exciting way to start my day. It's faster and I'm not stinky. But like when you get on a motorbike, you don't touch them, right? So like even in the act of like coming, getting on, like I know in America, like if I was going to ride a motorbike, like I would probably like, I might touch their shoulder, or like there's that act, but like in Thailand, like you wouldn't touch them at all. And that's just, it's just kind of part of the culture. It's just a little bit more distant culture. But in contrast, in Pakistan, they're just a much warmer culture. And so for Pakistani refugees, it's an awesome act of love to be able to embrace them and hug them, and that's a way that they experience and express love. Another act of love is quality time. And this is another one that's been really interesting to see different cultural expectations when it comes to quality time. So for me, I kind of just experience quality time where someone is just kind of willing to spend time with me, and like don't feel like they have to rush like to go somewhere else, right? Like they're just willing to give me freely their time. But then my sister, who's a couple of years younger than me, she also we were talking about kind of different ways of expressing love, and she said, she was like, oh yeah, quality time is like that's one of my love languages. And I was like, what does that look like? And she's like, that looks like people being on time. So if someone like shows up to a time when they're supposed to meet with me and I'm supposed to hang out with them like 15 minutes late, I feel like they don't really care about me, or they don't love me. And so, for Pakistani Christians, it can feel like even more extreme. You know, for a church service or even a meeting, it's just like totally normal for them to be like 30 minutes late, 45 minutes late. Like, that's just totally normal. And at first, it can be, it still is. it can be really frustrating, because like, you know, it feels like you aren't respecting my time. But what has helped me to have more grace and in some ways like respect it is realizing that usually, a lot of the times, being somewhere on time and being really strict with your time means sacrificing time with the person I'm with. So, like, for example, even going back to my, you know, for quality time for me is like spending a lot of time with me. You know, if I'm meeting someone and talk to them and they're like, okay, look, like, good to see you, I gotta go, like that prevents, that was kind of an opportunity in a way, that was an opportunity for me to love them or for them to love me, but the priority is being somewhere on time. So I'm not saying that to say like one is better than the other, but I think it's just important. It can help us to realize that sometimes being late can be a way of, it's just a way of life of loving other people. Like I was talking to a missionary and he was like, yeah, he was like, you know, Sadiq was like really late, but he was like, yeah, I met my cousin. I saw my cousin. I'm not just going to see my cousin and like say hi and walk by. Like if I see my cousin, like I'm going to talk to him and spend time with him. So of course I'm going to be late. And that's just like the expectation in the Pakistani culture is like, yeah, if you see someone, you spend time with them. So you're late. Who cares? You spend time with the next people forever, however long. Just like late for everything. And so the last kind of real practical way of loving that I found is affirmation. And this is something that really came true for me with during the time I was dating my wife. And we were actually dating, so she was in Thailand at the time, and I was in America. And a little background, we've been dating for about 2 months, and the fact that we were dating was a major accomplishment on my part. I've been working towards that for a while, and finally she said she finally prayed about it, and she said that God had given her peace to be in a relationship, but she also, possibly detecting a little bit overexcitement on my part, wanted to let me know that this is really practical. We work well together. You're a good guy. But like, just so you know, like, I don't have any feelings for you. She's like, that's okay. You know, feelings complicate things. Like, this makes sense. So I had some work to do. And so, you know, I learned that affirmation was her love language. And, you know, I feel like I'm working hard. I'm like, all right, like, I think some feelings would be good at some point. And so I asked her, I was like, hey, how am I doing in terms of affirmation? And I'm just like expecting a pat on the back. She was like, I mean, you could do better. I was like, okay. And so I was like, all right, well, I'm not gonna come up short again. And so I started every night I would write like at least a paragraph or two of like finding like affirming like different parts of her character or things she did. And I did it like without fail, at least once a day. And after a few weeks of doing that, the feelings changed, and so much to the point that in 3 months later, she was on a plane coming back to America, and we got married. and so the love is powerful, right? <It's> like, And affirmation also in Bangkok is that I have found that affirmation can be one of the most powerful transformational acts of love towards refugees. Because if you're a refugee in Bangkok, you can just feel like dirt, and you're even treated like that at a when some kids at a apartment complex or a school were going swimming. And they're just like normal kids, but they're Pakistani. And neighbors complained about the kids who were getting the swimming pool dirty because of their skin color. And so there's this sense, you know, you don't really have any rights. There's this sense of powerlessness. There's, you know, you have this sense of like just profound victim of everything. You know, you come from Pakistan where, you know, you're persecuted for being a Christian, and you finally escape to a country where you can be a Christian, but then, you know, you don't speak the language, you are in constant danger of arrest, and it feels like the only way to survive is by being a really, really good beggar. And that's a really terrible place to be, to feel like the only way I can survive is like being sufficiently pitiful that someone will just like feel bad for me and give me money. And so that takes away your humanity, right? And so one of the most important parts of what we do is, like, we don't actually, like, any Pakistani Christian in Bangkok is in a tough place. And the instinct is to actually, we wouldn't, most organizations wouldn't say that, but the instinct is to kind of make it a contest to see who's the most miserable. And, like, whoever has it worse, you give them money. And that's generally how we operate. It's like, oh, man, like, you lost, like, both of your limbs. Like, you really need help, right? But we've kind of, because of just that, how destroying of the human spirit we see that, is we've taken a step away from finding who's the most desperate. And instead, we ask, like, hey, like, instead of, and it's funny, like, I'll meet a refugee, and, like, they'll just immediately, like, start giving me these papers of, like, how horrible life was in Pakistan, their medical bills, their rent bills, like, trying to show me how hard their life is. And so, but instead of asking people to show us how bad their life is in Bangkok, we ask them to tell us, what do you think God wants you to do in Bangkok? So what we say is, like, you are a powerful person, and that you have skills and gifts to offer Bangkok, and Bangkok is a really, really hard place. But we believe that no matter how hard our situation, like, we believe that God has a purpose for us, and that no matter how bad it is, He gives us opportunities to learn and to grow and to serve. And so we ask them, hey, like, what do you think God is calling you to do with your time here? And it's awesome just to see, it's almost this, like, lightness that comes in this frame of, like, oh, like, this isn't just about me. The way I get money isn't by being a beggar. And just being reminded, like, I have skills. Like, I have things to offer. I can be a blessing. And really, it's been amazing to see refugees stand up and be a blessing to Bangkok. It's really, you know, it's so easy for us to think, oh, like, refugees are people who need help, but refugees can be a blessing. And, you know, we have refugees who have started schools, who are across the city. We have people who are serving in church, Sunday school classes, ushers. We have refugees who are leading people to Christ. And so, and that's, again, the power of love and really the power of affirmation. When we speak truth, when we speak hope into people's lives, it can change their lives. One last thing I want to touch on before I close up with some stories from Bangkok is, and this is something I've seen, is that I know, like, I'm kind of an introvert, so it's really easy for me, like, I can be really content just, like, being alone, like, having some, like, being by myself. But I think one of the most important parts of love, being able to love people, is to be with people. And in American society, we have these, like, this independence, and, you know, we're comfortable kind of depending on ourselves, but God wants us to be in community. And I see that. I think that the verse that paints the picture of that most clearly is Psalm 133. And it says, "Behold how good and pleasant it is for brothers to dwell together in unity. It is like precious oil upon the head, coming down the beard, even Aaron's beard, coming down upon the edges of his robe." And I think that the key there is just, like, how much joy it brings to God's heart for us to be living in community, to be, you know, interdependent on each other. And for me, practically, like, that's meant, like, sometimes, like, various times, like, we've lived with friends, and not just because it can be economical, but it also, like, living with people gives us the opportunity to really do life and really care for people. I know personally, like, one of the times when I've most experienced love has been when I was on a mission trip. I was actually in New York. It was a mission trip to a drug and alcohol rehab center here, and it was, you know, 40 or 50 guys who, you know, we're all, for a week, we didn't really have anything specifically we were doing. We just came and helped. So they were doing, you know, they had various work they were doing. So we just joined them in their work. But it was a community that was focused on Christ. We ate together. We worked together. We worshiped together. And just that feeling of community, that act of living with people, just created this profound sense of love that I hadn't experienced before. So the challenge there is don't be afraid to spend extra time with people, to choose living situations that let you live in community. So now talking about, we're going to talk about living life in Bangkok. So I want to start with a story that's been really challenging for us and has kind of made you, has made me kind of question the power of love. And that's, so we've been, there's a, some of you guys, for those of you who get our newsletter, you'll know about a lady by the name of Naomi. And she has been one of the refugees who has had the hardest in Bangkok. She had four kids, and she already felt like she was drowning. She had like four kids under five or six, and she already felt like she was drowning. And when she found out she was pregnant with a fifth, she was already drowning, and she could hardly conceptualize, like, how am I going to live with a fifth child? Like, I can't imagine how I'm going to do it. And so we ended up actually, like, my wife and I ended up taking care of her baby for a while, and you know, we've helped take care of the older kids sometimes, but just doing everything we can to help her. And then, but a few weeks ago, Naomi was out going on a walk just by herself to get food for her children, and she got arrested by immigration police. And it was just, when we first heard out about it, I was like, what? Like, it, and we, you know, they took her to the police department, and we did everything we could to, you know, explain, like, hey, listen, like, this is a mother with five kids on the outside. Like, please, like, this is not like a potential terrorist in Bangkok. Like, can you please just, like, show her some mercy and let her be with her kids? But it wasn't possible. And so they took her to the IDC. At that point, our hope was, okay, can we, like, hope maybe we can get bail. So if you're registered with UNHCR, at the UNHCR, it's possible for them to kind of, for you to raise money and for them to let you out on bail. It hasn't happened in like 2.5 years, but this is also just an incredibly exceptional case. And so we wanted to see what we could do. And we managed to raise the money. We had some people who had a relationship. Some of our church partners have a relationship with officials at the IDC. And so we were starting to have hope, like, hey, like, bail really could be a possibility. But then 1 week later, the UNHCR officially closed her case. And so what that means is they said, you know, we've made a final determination, like, you don't fit our definition of refugee, and so we won't, like, what they technically say is you are no longer a person of concern. So that means you're not eligible for any kind of assistance or any kind of advocacy. And in the case of this, that means they won't talk to the IDC and kind of represent that you're someone who needs bail. And so at that point, the possibility of bail was eliminated. And it's these, and you just feel, when that happens, like, you feel powerless. You know, and we've, you know, been trying to care for and love this poor mama, and now she's in, like, a modern-day concentration camp. And so, but for me, what has spoken to me and what's powerful to me is a verse, kind of, as we process these challenges right now, because we don't know what the future holds for her. There's nothing particularly hopeful right now. But is Matthew 25:34. That's where I'll start. And it says, then the king will say to those on his right, and this is one of the last things Jesus says before he starts his journey to the cross. So there's something powerful about this being one of the last things he says to his disciple before the cross. And he says, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. And I think for Americans, like for me, it's really easy to get into this like problem-solving mindset where any action I take, like I want it to be solving a problem. And so with someone like Noreen, it's easy to see all these problems and there's this like yearning, like, all right, like I want to solve this problem, these problems she has. But this, you know, what is awesome to me, what is like crazy to me about these verses is this idea that just, you know, by giving someone food, by visiting someone in prison, by giving someone water, like not only are we loving them, but we're actually loving Jesus. This like crazy opportunity to love Jesus. And what strikes me in these verses is it's not, there's no problem being solved here, right? Like, but it's enough, and it's, and God gives so much favor on this idea of loving someone and being with someone in their suffering. And so that's been what is encouraging to me, is this idea that like God, you know, doesn't necessarily call us to solve Noreen's problems, but he calls us to love her. And when we bring her food, when we bring her kids so she can see her kids, when we see her and spend time with her in prison, you know, that that is the love that God calls us to do, and we're actually loving Jesus when we do that. And that's an awesome opportunity and something that it's okay to be in suffering, because our God, one of the things that makes our God great is that he is a God who suffers with us. And we're called to minister to those who are suffering. I want to circle back now, because we talked about that church at the beginning where they had the food distribution program. And so what we ended up doing with that church is, and then the reason that the food distribution program wasn't full of love was because it had become a bureaucracy, right? This guy was giving 500 different people a bag of food, right? Like, he didn't know their names. They probably knew his name, but he didn't know their names. He didn't know what they were going through. And for them, they just felt like, okay, like I correctly filled out the paperwork, or I met these requirements, and this is like almost like this obligation you have to me. And so it had, even though it was doing something good, it had taken love out of the equation. And for us, like the key for us is like we want to make sure that we are loving refugees. And so what we ended up doing at this church was implementing what we call our advocacy program, which means that for every refugee who we help, there is someone at the church who knows them and who we work through to help them. And so, you know, this isn't that now when a refugee receives help, you know, they receive a hug sometimes. You know, they receive the gift of assistance. The advocates, you know, kind of like us, they can help watch the kids, but there's that actual relationship, and by working in that relationship, refugees experience love. Now that the church has decided they stopped the assistance program, but now they have 40 or 50 different volunteers in the church who are visiting the IDC and who are working as advocates for specific families, so that hundreds of families at that church are able to experience love. So to conclude, kind of continuing on the theme of the power of love. It's easy to sometimes, we pray for things. We'll talk about prayer a little bit, because prayer is also an act of love. It's easy to pray for things and then not rejoice when they happen necessarily, and to forget that we prayed for them, I think. And so, do you guys believe in the power of prayer? All right. So, about a year and a half ago when I was here, I shared with you the story of Shabazz. And this is the guy who's in prison. I've been visiting him since 2015. And his story just really touched my heart, because he's by himself, and he's in the IDC with his mom, who's elderly. But then his wife and three daughters were on the outside. And at the time, there was real hope that he would be able to go to the U.S. and see his daughters again and experience freedom. But a whole another year passed, and it didn't seem like anything was moving forward. And I remember the first time I saw him, one of the things that really struck me about Shabazz was he was so full of hope and energy. You know, he was in the IDC. He was in a tough spot, but he was like very much hopeful. But as the years, you know, in this concentration camp passed, you know, and as like seemed like hope was fading, I could just see in his eyes there was this hope was fading, and it was really sad for me to see. But we kept praying, and you kept praying. And I want to thank you guys for being so faithful in your prayers. Because of those prayers, about 3 weeks ago, I was at the airport, and I got to be there for the moment when the prison officials opened up the door on the cage, the cage on a truck, and let Shabazz step out and experience freedom for the first time. And as he walked into the airport, his three daughters just like ran to them, and he was trying to hold all three daughters at the same time. And that night, Shabazz, his wife, and his three girls got on a plane, and they're now in Houston, Texas. And Shabazz gets to be with his girls again. So remember the power of prayer. Remember the power of love, and whether loving means sitting with and just being with someone in their suffering, or love means changing somebody's life, do it. So thank you, guys.
That's okay. Loud and early. I'll be there. So thank you, Chris. And we asked some questions at First Service, our government as well. There are places where people can.
There are people who've stayed there 5-10 years because it's meant as a temporary place before people get deported. But. If you're in Pakistan, you have to they don't forcibly deport you, which is good, but like they won't, even if you want to go back, like you got to pay for your own plane ticket. And so until you are ready to go back, they'll keep you there. Yeah. Now her mother is taking care of the 5 kids. And she's in a tough spot. There is someone who's taking care of the kids right now. And there are other people like in our kind of who are part of our work who are helping them.